Hi, I'm Beth Gibbs. And every week at this time, Chris takes a look at the current issues of For Your Health. Our first article is titled, Supreme Court's Anti-Abortion Conservatives Could Restrict Abortion Pills Sent by Mail, Even in Blue States, by David Savage for the Tribune News Service. The Supreme Court's anti-abortion majority is considering whether to order a reversal in U.S. drug laws and restrict women from obtaining abortion medication at pharmacies or through the mail. A ruling to restrict the most common method of abortion would limit the rights of women in California and other states where abortion remains legal. Quote, we may have thought we were protected because California is supportive of abortion. But this decision on abortion pills will be national in scope, said Dr. Daniel Grossman, a professor of obstetrics at UC San Francisco. The case is the most significant abortion question to come before the court since it overturned the constitutional right to abortion. In that Dobbs ruling 2 years ago, the 5-4 majority sought to reassure those who live in states where abortion remains protected. Judges should not make the rules on abortion, they said, promising to return that authority to the people and their elected representatives. But that pledge faces a major test. Conservative judges in Texas have shown themselves very willing to rewrite the rules for abortion medication and to impose their rules in blue states. Whether they prevail now depends on the three conservative justices appointed by President Trump who were crucial to overturning Roe v. Wade. Justices Neil Gorsuch, Brett Kavanaugh, and Amy Coney Barrett. If all three join with Justices Clarence Thomas and Samuel Alito, they could roll back the use of abortion pills. Quote, it could eliminate telemedicine and reimpose the in-person dispensing requirement, said Grossman. It could also set a very bad precedent for the FDA. Several years after the drug mifepristone had been legalized in much of Europe, the Food and Drug Administration in 2000 approved its use as a safe and effective means of ending an early pregnancy. Since 2016, the agency has liberalized its regulations to permit patients to consult a doctor through telemedicine and to obtain the pills without traveling to a clinic. It is now part of a two-drug combination accounting for more than half of U.S. abortions. When taken in combination with misoprostol, the pills cause cramping and some bleeding. It can sometimes require a doctor's intervention to complete the abortion, but the FDA says serious complications are exceedingly rare, noting that more than 5 million women in the U.S. have used the medication since 2000. More than a dozen major medical groups, led by the American College of Obstetrics and Gynecologists and the American Medical Association, said in Friend of the Court briefs that 2 decades of studies have shown the drugs are safe. Quote, when used in medication abortion, major adverse events, significant infection, excessive blood loss, or hospitalization occur in less than 0.32% of patients, they wrote. Recently, however, the court heard a broad attack on the FDA from attorney Aaron Hawley, the wife of Republican Missouri Senator Josh Hawley and a former law clerk to Chief Justice John Roberts. She says the court should not turn a blind eye to FDA's patently unreasonable actions here, which jeopardize women's health throughout the nation, end quote. Hawley is not representing women who say they were injured by the drugs of doctors who prescribed the medication. Instead, she is representing a group of doctors who oppose abortion on religious and moral grounds. She argues they have legal standing to sue the FDA because some of the group's members work in emergency rooms and they could be forced to treat patients who took abortion pills and went to a hospital because of bleeding or other complications. Quote, when faced with these emergencies, the doctors have no choice but to provide immediate treatment, even though this kind of participation in an elective abortion harms their consciences and injures them in other ways, Hawley wrote in her brief to the court. Shortly after the Supreme Court repealed the right to abortion in the Dobbs case, Hawley filed a lawsuit in Amarillo, Texas, seeking the repeal of the FDA's approval of mifepristone. The location was no accident. Her suit would come before U.S. District Judge Matthew Kaczmarek, a Trump appointee who has been an outspoken foe of same-sex marriage and LGBTQ plus rights. Kaczmarek has served as Deputy General Counsel for First Liberty Institute, a Christian conservative nonprofit that works on religious freedom cases, and had criticized the Supreme Court's landmark 1973 Roe v. Wade decision before its reversal. In past decades, conservatives often railed against judicial activism and judges who legislate from the bench. In recent years, however, conservative activists have gone before judges in red states seeking to win major changes in the law that they could not win from Congress or the White House. As predicted, Kaczmarek handed down a broad ruling against what he called chemical abortion and ordered the FDA to suspend its approval of the drugs. In a ruling using language common to anti-abortion groups, Kaczmarek said the studies submitted by the FDA did not convince him mifepristone was safe. The government rushed to appeal last April, and the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Fifth District agreed to limit Kaczmarek's ruling. By a 2-1 vote, the appeals court said it was too late to unravel the approval of the drug in 2000. But not too late to overturn the FDA's regulations that since 2016 have made it easier for women to obtain the pills. Biden Administrator Solicitor General Elizabeth B. Preloger called the case a first. She said, quote, it marks the first time any court has restricted access to an FDA-approved drug by second-guessing FDA's expert judgment about the conditions required to assure the drug's safe use. She urged the Supreme Court to put the lower court rulings on hold, and the justices did so over dissents by Thomas and Alito. A few months later, the court agreed to rule in the case of FDA versus Alliance for Hippocratic Medicine. Abortion rights advocates are troubled that the case has gotten so far. Protesters demonstrated at the March for Reproductive Rights, organized by Women's March LA on April 15, 2023, in Los Angeles, California. The march was organized in response to the Texas federal judge's ruling to rescind the FDA approval of the abortion pill, mifepristone. U.S. Vice President Kamala Harris made a surprise appearance and a speech at the event. Quote, this makes a mockery of our legal system, said Julia Kay, an attorney for the American Civil Liberties Union. This is a group of anti-abortion extremists going before a hand-picked judge and using junk science and sham claims about women's health to serve their true goal of making abortion inaccessible. The Solicitor General representing the FDA will urge the court to end the case quietly by throwing out the lawsuit. Usually, the court has said plaintiffs have standing to sue over a law or regulation only if they are or will be personally injured by it. The anti-abortion doctors who sued, quote, do not prescribe mifepristone, and FDA's actions allowing other providers to prescribe the drug do not require them to do or refrain from doing anything, Preloger wrote in her brief to the court. Quote, they have not identified even a single doctor among their thousands of members who has ever been required to perform an abortion in the decades that mifepristone has been on the market. The next article is titled, Lioness Caregiver's Love Brings Connecticut Woman Back from the Brink of Death, Her Soul Sparked Again, by Pamela McLaughlin for the Hartford Courant. When Mina Rosenberg's full-time caregiver, Charlotte Chieri, took a trip home to Ghana last year, Rosenberg went so downhill that she was put in hospice care. Her daughter paid for her funeral, and the grandchildren were warned. But Mina, 95, was still around when Chieri returned, and despite the grim prognosis, the caregiver told the daughter, Sally Rosenberg, not to worry, as, quote, your mom's going to be outside near her favorite tree come spring. Here it is spring, and Mina is still living the good life in Hoffman Summerwood, an assisted living facility in West Hartford. It's that kind of determination and attention to care that has earned Chieri the Ultimate Platinum Caregiver of the Year Award by her employer, Assisted Living Home Care Services. The annual award comes with a $5,000 bonus. Quote, she is one of those caregivers that goes absolutely above and beyond, said Mario D'Aquila, chief operating officer and co-owner of the home care agency. It's truly in her character to love seniors and elderly folks. Chieri, 51, came to the United States from Ghana in 2013 to live with an uncle in New York. She became a 24/7 caregiver to Mina after the pandemic, sleeping in her living room. Chieri said she loves taking care of people, quote, to keep them happy, and that she believes in the adage, what goes around comes around. I look at them like my grandmother, my own, she said. They may say something that doesn't make sense, but I comply. You have to listen to them. She describes Mina, a Holocaust survivor, as a quiet woman who knows her surroundings and is polite, saying thank you often. One of the qualities that Chieri is proud of and that helped her earn the award is that she's willing to help anyone on the spot. D'Aquila said he received glowing letters not only from Sally Rosenberg, but also others in assisted living and fellow employees, including the facility's janitor. Quote, I will see you, greet you, help anybody, Chieri said. Chieri said she was surprised by the award and will use some of the money toward a trip to Ghana in May to take care of her mother, who had a stroke, in order to give her sister a break. But she will be back soon to resume caring for Mina. Quote, if Mina will be able to be alive at 100, I'll be able to take care of her, Chieri said. It gives me joy. Sally Rosenberg of Glastonbury said her mom is bedridden and her care is tricky, involving a balancing act with nutrition, liquids, and positioning. Sally Rosenberg said she doesn't believe her mom would have lived this long without Chieri's care. She is a lioness taking care of her cub, and no one is going to mess with my mother, Sally Rosenberg said, noting Chieri watches every detail. I'm very much in debt to Charlotte for her professionalism and kindness. Rabbi Aaron Jaffe recalled the time when Chieri was away on vacation and Mina declined, so the family was preparing for the worst. Once Charlotte returned, Mina perked up and her soul sparked again, Jaffe said. It was very apparent that Mina's return to us was due to the care, love, and dedication that Charlotte has for her. Sally Rosenberg said her mom is a kind, agreeable person who went through a horrible time during the Holocaust. I feel very lucky, she said. The next article is titled, Concerns Grow Over Quality of Care as Investor Groups by Not-for-Profit Nursing Homes, by Harris Mayer for the Tribune News Service. Shelley Olson's mother, who has dementia, has lived at the Scandia Village Nursing Home in rural Sister Bay, Wisconsin, for almost 5 years. At first, Olson said, her mother received great care at the facility, then owned by a not-for-profit organization, the Evangelical Lutheran Good Samaritan Society. Then in 2019, Sanford Health, a not-for-profit, tax-exempt hospital system, acquired the nursing home. The COVID-19 pandemic struck soon after. From then on, the facility was regularly short of staff, and residents endured long wait times and other care problems, said Olson, a registered nurse who formerly worked at the facility. Now Scandia Village has a new for-profit owner, Continuum Healthcare. Olson said she was reassured when Continuum hired two locals as the facility's new administrator and nursing director. But Kathy Wagner, a former Scandia Village nursing director, is not optimistic. Quote, the for-profit owner will face the same problem, said Wagner, who is now retired and serves on an informal task force that monitors the facility's quality of care. Quote, no one has articulated what the for-profit owner will bring to the table to change the picture. The sale of Scandia Village this year is part of a trend of for-profit companies, including private equity groups and real estate investment trusts, snapping up struggling not-for-profit nursing homes, many of which were operated for decades by Lutheran, Catholic, Jewish, and other faith-based organizations. The pace of sales has ticked up, reaching a high last year, according to Ziegler Investment Banking. Since 2015, 900 not-for-profit nursing homes and senior living communities nationwide have changed hands, with more than half of them acquired by for-profit operators. For-profit groups own about 72% of the roughly 15,000 nursing homes in the United States, which serve more than 1.3 million residents. While overall for-profit ownership percentage hasn't notably increased in recent years, the type of for-profit companies that own these facilities has shifted toward private equity, real estate investment trusts, and complicated ownership structures, said David Grabowski, a professor of healthcare policy at Harvard Medical School. Consumer advocates, researchers, and regulators are leery about this trend. They point to studies showing that nursing homes owned by for-profit companies, particularly investors in private equity and real estate, tend to have skimpier staffing, lower quality ratings, and more regulatory violations. Motivated by these concerns, the Biden administration issued a rule last fall that requires nursing homes to disclose more information about their owners and management firms. Executives at not-for-profit organizations, as well as researchers who study nursing homes, wonder how for-profit companies can accomplish what the previous not-for-profit owners could not, reviving financially struggling nursing homes. Quote, I don't know where these investor groups can see savings without cutting back on the level of quality, Grabowski said. Part of the problem is that to boost profits, many for-profit operators set up a network of related companies to provide fee-based services such as management, physical therapy, and staffing. They may also sell a nursing home's real estate to a sister company, which then charges high rent. These payments cut into the available operating funds to provide adequate staffing and quality care. Last year, New York Attorney General Letitia James sued the for-profit owners of four nursing homes for financial fraud and resident neglect, alleging that they used more than $83 million in public funds to enrich themselves through a complex network of related companies while providing horrendous care. Quote, when nonprofits are sold, you start to see a precipitous decline in quality, said Sam Brooks, director of public policy for the National Consumer Voice for Quality Long-Term Care. Nonprofits generally staff well above for-profits. When churches and nonprofits divest these homes, Four prophets move in, and the care gets really bad. The leaders of not-for-profits that have sold facilities to for-profit operators cite a variety of reasons for exiting or downsizing. Those reasons include state Medicaid payment rates that are too low to cover operating costs, and a shortage of nursing and other staffers that makes it hard to maintain quality care. In addition, they say their facilities have seen fewer admissions, at least partly because Medicare Advantage plans have tightened coverage policies for rehabilitation care in nursing homes. Susan McCrary, chief executive of St. Ignatius Community Services in Philadelphia, said her organization sold its nursing home because it was losing money. She said low state Medicaid rates forced their hand, even after the state bolstered its Medicaid payments by 17.5% in January of 2023. McCrary said the St. Ignatius board worried the losses would jeopardize the organization's ability to continue its mission of serving low-income seniors, for whom it also operates three independent living and assisted living buildings. At the same time, quote, our board definitely had concerns about selling to a for-profit, because we're aware of the research that shows the quality of care is not the same as with a nonprofit, McCrary said. But we knew we needed to move forward with this process to continue our services in West Philadelphia. Nate Schema, CEO of the Evangelical Lutheran Good Samaritan Society, said his organization decided to sell some of its long-term care facilities to Continuum Healthcare, a New Jersey-based corporation, and a second company, Idaho-based Cascadia Healthcare, as part of its strategy to better serve its communities. Good Samaritan now operates in seven Midwestern states, down from 22 states. Consolidating markets better enables his organization to launch programs for nursing home residents in conjunction with Sanford's hospitals and clinics. Quote, we've been very intentional about finding quality partners to carry on our mission, Schema said. Unfortunately, we haven't seen a lot of nonprofit providers coming to us. Continuum, which took over Scandia Village Nursing Home in January, will address staffing shortages by improving wages, benefits, and career opportunities, said Tom Hodges, the corporation's communication director. Continuum, which is owned by private investors and commercial lenders, owns eight nursing homes in four states. Similarly, Steve Lefort, Cascadia's executive vice president, said his company has revived the finances of the nine Good Samaritan nursing homes it took over in the Pacific Northwest, partly by attracting more patient referrals and strengthening relationships with state policymakers in the hope, quote, it leads to more realistic Medicaid rates. He said Cascadia has also focused on workplace culture, such as by not using workers from staffing agencies and on empowering those who run the individual facilities to select vendors for pharmacy, rehabilitation, and other services. Cascadia, he says, does not use tactics like contracting with sister vendors to boost its profits. That type of organization gives the whole industry a bad name, said Lefort. The overall perception of for-profit corporations is unfair, said Zach Schamberg, CEO of the Pennsylvania Healthcare Association, because all nursing homes are struggling under inadequate Medicaid rates and high labor costs due to a shortage in workers. He said he hopes that Pennsylvania's Medicaid rate increase, plus a new minimum staffing requirement, and a mandate that 70% of total costs be dedicated to resident care will address the financial and quality issues. Nursing homes in Pennsylvania and across the country are also lobbying state lawmakers and the federal government to offer extra payments tied to quality outcomes for residents. Quote, if there aren't for-profit entities to buy these facilities are closing, which would exacerbate the existing access to care crisis as the population gets older, said Schomburg. The next article is titled, A Promising Glioblastoma Clinical Trial. Cancer researchers say tumors dramatically shrunk, by Rick Sobey for the Boston Herald. A new glioblastoma study is providing a glimmer of hope for those battling the aggressive and fast-growing brain tumor, as a novel treatment helped dramatically shrink the tumor in patients. A phase one clinical trial out of Massachusetts General Hospital in Boston recently used a new cell therapy in patients with recurring glioblastoma. Just days after a single treatment, the tumors dramatically reduced in size, according to the Mass General Cancer Center researchers. One patient even saw near complete tumor regression. Quote, these results are exciting, but they are also just the beginning. They tell us that we are on the right track in pursuing a therapy that has the potential to change the outlook for this intractable disease, said Marcella Mouse, director of the Cellular Immunotherapy Program at Mass General Cancer Center. We haven't cured patients yet, but that is our audacious goal, she added. MRI scans for the three patients with recurrent glioblastoma conducted before and after the treatment showed major shrinkage in the tumor size. The trial tested a new type of CAR T-cell therapy, which arms the body's own cells to fight the cancer. A patient's cells are extracted, modified to produce proteins on their surface called chimeric antigen receptors, and then injected back into the body to target the tumor directly. In the trial, a 57-year-old woman who was treated with the CAR T cells, an MRI 5 days later after a single infusion of CAR T cells, showed near complete tumor regression. Also, a 72-year-old man was treated with a single infusion of CAR T cells. 2 days after receiving CAR T cells, an MRI showed a decrease in the tumor size by 18.5%. By day 69, the tumor had decreased by 60.7%, and the response was sustained for more than 6 months. Despite the remarkable responses among the first three patients, the tumors eventually recurred within 6 months in two of the study's patients, so the researchers are now working to find new ways to extend the durability of the treatment. Quote, we report a dramatic and rapid response in these three patients, said co-author Elizabeth Gerstner, a neuro-oncologist in the Department of Neurology at Massachusetts General Hospital. Our work to date shows signs that we are making progress, but there is more to do, she added. The new approach is a result of years of collaboration and innovation springing from Mouse's lab. This is a story of bench-to-bedside therapy, with a novel cell therapy designed in the laboratories of the Massachusetts General Hospital and translated for patient use within 5 years to meet an urgent need, said Brian Choi, neurosurgeon and associate director of the Center for Brain Tumor Immunology and Immunotherapy, Cellular Immunotherapy Program, Mass General Cancer Center, and Department of Neurosurgery. Quote, the CAR T platform has revolutionized how we think about treating patients with cancer. But solid tumors like glioblastoma have remained challenging to treat, because not all cancer cells are exactly alike, and cells within the tumor vary, Choi added. Our approach combines two forms of therapy, allowing us to treat glioblastoma in a broader, potentially more effective way. And that's all the time we have for in this week's look at For Your Health. If you have questions about this or other programs on the Chris Radio, please call the Chris Listener Line at 860-727-9579. 860-727-9579. I'm Beth Gibbs. So long till next time.
Good morning. We're talking about diabetes this morning. This is a study about an obesity treatment for women only. The source is the University of Virginia's health system. University of Virginia School of Medicine researchers have identified a potential way to battle the health effects of obesity and type 2 diabetes in women after discovering an important factor that could determine how their bodies use and store fat. Based on their new discovery, the researchers, led by Associate Professor of Biomedical Engineering, Met Sivilp, PhD, were able to change whether female lab mice's bodies stored fat subcutaneously, that means under the skin, or viscerally, which means wrapped around the organs. While visceral fat goes unseen, hidden deep inside the body, it can be particularly harmful to good health. The researchers say their results in mice suggest that a similar approach could help treat the effects of obesity and battle metabolic diseases such as diabetes in women. There is a strong need for targeted therapies against metabolic abnormalities caused by obesity and diabetes, said the study's first author, Qi Yang, PhD, of UVA's Center for Public Health Genomics. We hope that increasing KLF-14 abundance in fat cells of females with obesity and diabetes may provide a novel treatment option to alleviate these metabolic abnormalities. How we store fat. Men and women store fat differently. Men tend to be more apple-shaped, meaning they store fat around the waist, while women tend to be more pear-shaped. This is because women store more subcutaneous fat and less visceral fat in their lower body. Sivilek's new findings help explain why. Sivilek and his team were investigating a particular gene, KLF-14, that has been linked to many different metabolic problems, including type 2 diabetes and coronary artery disease. These health associations are more pronounced in women than men, but scientists haven't understood the reason. Sivilek and his collaborators found that the KLF-14 gene is a key regulator of how the female body uses lipids, that's fats. The gene makes a protein that plays a critical in how fat cells form, what type of fat they turn into, and where they are stored. When Sivilek's team blocked the production of this protein in lab mice, they noticed very different effects in males and females. Females gained fat, while males lost it. The females also stored fat differently than normal, gaining more visceral fat and less subcutaneous fat. There were other sex-specific changes as well. The female mice suffered slower metabolic rates and faster breathing, suggesting they were relying more on carbohydrates for fuel. And their bodies became less efficient at managing triglycerides, a type of fat in the blood. Interestingly, when the researchers amped up the production of the KLF-14 protein in female mice, the mice lost weight, but the male mice did not. Based on what they found, the researchers believed that increasing production of the KLF-14 protein in fat cells in women may offer a way to treat the harmful effects of obesity and type 2 diabetes. More research will be needed, but the researchers say it is promising that their mouse findings align closely with what we see in humans. We are now working to create a drug delivery system that will target fat cells and deliver a small molecule to increase KLF-14 abundance, Sivilek said. We hope to translate our laboratory findings to the clinic to help women fight the effects of obesity and diabetes. We have a study here that looks at the discovery of new immune process that regulates inflammation in human fat, which may help manage obesity. And the source is the Trinity College, Dublin. Irish and German scientists have just identified how specific immune cells can work together in fat to cause inflammation that leads to weight gain and obesity. Their work pinpoints new avenues to exploit the regulation of that inflammation in fat tissue, thereby suggesting new ways to manage obesity. There is a global epidemic in obesity in adults and children, with obese people predisposed to developing diabetes, cardiovascular disease, and cancer. New therapies are needed to help tackle this issue. In their research, the scientists identified how checkpoint proteins and immune cells alter inflammatory cells within the fat tissue to cause obesity. In people with obesity, that's a body mass index, or BMI, greater than 30 kilograms per metric squared, these changes in checkpoint expression in the visceral fat was predictive of the person's weight. The scientists then showed that modifications in the so-called immune checkpoint proteins of mice on a Western high-fat diet were linked to dramatic reductions in the development of obesity and diabetes. The study, published in the leading international biomedical journal, Science Translational Medicine, was led by Professor Padraig Fallon from Trinity College Dublin School of Medicine, and Dr. Christian Schwartz, a former EMBO fellow in Trinity and now a principal investigator at the University Hospital Erlangen. Professor Fallon commented, "This new process of checkpoint regulation of cells in visceral fat of obese individuals advances our understanding of how the immune system controls diet-induced weight gain that can lead to conditions such as obesity and type 2 diabetes. Our discovery has broader impacts on addressing how obesity influences comorbidity and other diseases, as shown in the COVID-19 pandemic, where obese individuals that are infected with the SARS-CoV-2 are more likely to develop severe disease that requires intensive care and also have an increased risk of mortality." Dr. Schwartz commented, "In our study, we analyzed the function of immune checkpoints on specific cells, and it is fascinating to see that a small change on one of many cell populations in the fat has such an impact on the outcome of the disease. Only through our basic research efforts using preclinical models were we able to gain access to patient samples and link our findings to human disease. It will be interesting to investigate now how we can manipulate this checkpoint on specific cell populations of interest to help people with obesity." The study investigated inflammatory changes in patients with obesity, with or without type 2 diabetes, in collaboration with Dr. Andy Hogan, that's Maynooth University, Professors Donald O'Shea and Helen Hennigan, St. Vincent's Hospital and University College Dublin, and Dr. Christian Krautz, University Hospital Erlangen. We are now looking at the chronic lactate exposure leads to cellular disruptions implicated in cancer and possibly type 2 diabetes. The study shows the accumulation of chronic cellular lactate compose health risks over time. The source is the University of Colorado Anschutz Medical Campus. Acute amounts of lactate, like those generated during exercise, are probably required for healthy cells. But chronic exposure causes cellular disruption, which can lead to cancer, heart failure, and type 2 diabetes, according to a new study by scientists at the University of Colorado and Schutz Medical Campus. The study was published in the journal Frontiers in Nutrition. We know that lactate is not just a waste product, said lead author Ingo San Milan, PhD, assistant professor at the University of Colorado School of Medicine and associate professor at the University of Colorado, Colorado Springs. It has significant signaling and regulation properties at the cellular level. Lactate, a byproduct of glucose, is a major source of energy for the cell, especially the mitochondria. It's a preferred fuel over glucose in the beating heart, muscles, and the brain. The substance is also produced during exercise and rapidly cleared from the body through the mitochondria, which swiftly oxidizes it. But Sam Milan and his colleagues found that when rats were exposed to lactate for up to 48 hours, they became more susceptible to disease. We know that when lactate is acutely exposed to cells, like during exercise, it is beneficial, Sam Milan says. But chronic exposure disrupts cellular metabolism entirely. The researchers focused on whether chronic lactate exposure could decrease the activity of cardiac mitochondria, cause cellular destruction, and lead to metabolic inflexibility of the heart. They discovered that long-term lactate exposure led to a significant decrease in fatty acid transport, alterations of a key component in mitochondrial membranes, known as cardiolipin, and decreases in mitochondrial ATP, or energy production. It also prompted increases in free radicals that could cause heart failure and play a role in type 2 diabetes. We found that dysregulated lactate is probably a major player in disease, Sam Milan said. This is a rat model, but we believe the results would be similar in human cells. The next step is determining the mechanisms involved in the decreased ability to clear lactate. Sam Milan, who in addition to his research trains top athletes, including last year's winner of the Tour de France, has done extensive research into the relationship between lactate and cancer and the overall importance of mitochondrial health. In a previous study, his research group showed that lactate could be a master regulator of carcinogenesis, the process that turns a normal cell into a cancer cell. Cancer cells are producing glucose all the time, and they produce lactate all the time, and it is never cleared out like it is during exercise. This lactate accumulation regulates the expression of many key genes involved in cancer, as we have recently shown. For Sam Milan, it comes down to mitochondrial health. We believe that a primary mitochondrial impairment or dysfunction could lead to excessive lactate accumulation leading to disease, he said. And right now, the only medication we have to fix mitochondrial function is exercise. Our next study looks at Nordic diet lowers cholesterol and blood sugar, even if you don't lose weight. The source is the University of Copenhagen Faculty of Science. Berries, veggies, fish, whole grains, and rapeseed oil. These are the main ingredients of the Nordic diet concept that, for the past decade, have been recognized as extremely healthy, tasty, and sustainable. The diet can prevent obesity and reduce the risk of cardiovascular disease, type 2 diabetes, high blood pressure, and high cholesterol. Until now, Nordic diet research has primarily been linked to the diet's positive health effect following weight loss. But a new analysis conducted by University of Copenhagen researchers, among others, makes it clear that a Nordic diet has positive health benefits, regardless of whether one loses weight or not. It's surprising because most people believe that positive effects on blood sugar and cholesterol are solely due to weight loss. Here, we have found that this is not to be the case. Other mechanisms are also at play, explains Lars Ove Dragsted, a researcher and head of section at the University of Copenhagen's Department of Nutrition, Exercise and Sports. Together with researchers from Finland, Norway, Sweden and Iceland, Dragsted examined blood and urine samples from 200 people over the age of 50, all with elevated BMI, that's the body mass index, and increased risk of diabetes and cardiovascular disease. The participants were divided into two groups. One provided foods according to Nordic dietary recommendations and a control group on their habitual diet. After 6 months of monitoring, the result was clear. The group that had been on the Nordic diet for 6 months became significantly healthier, with lower cholesterol levels, lower overall levels of both saturated and unsaturated fat in the blood, and better regulation of glucose compared to the control group. We kept the group on the Nordic diet weight stable, meaning that we asked them to eat more if they lost weight. Even without weight loss, we could see an improvement in their health, explains Lars Ove Dragsted. The fat makes us healthy. Instead of weight loss alone, the researchers point to the unique composition of fats in a Nordic diet as a possible explanation for the significant health benefits. By analyzing the bloods of participants, we could see that those who benefited from the dietary changes had different fat-soluble substances than the control group. These are substances that appear to be linked to unsaturated fatty acids from oils in the Nordic diet. This is a sign that Nordic dietary fats probably play most significant role for the health effects seen here, which I hadn't expected, said Lars Ove Dragsted. Fats in the Nordic diet come from fish, flaxseed, sunflower, and rapeseed, otherwise known as canola here, among other things. As a whole, they constitute a very beneficial mix for the body, although the researchers have yet to accurately explain why these fats seem to lower both blood sugar and cholesterol levels. We can only speculate as to why a change in fat composition benefits our health so greatly. However, we can confirm that the absence of highly processed food and less saturated fats from animals have a very positive effect on us. So the fat composition in the Nordic diet, which is higher in omega-3 and omega-6 unsaturated fats, is probably a considerable part of the explanation for the health effects we find from the Nordic diet, even when the weight of participants remains constant, concludes Lars Ove Dragsted. The facts about the Nordic nutrition recommendations. The Nordic nutrition recommendations were adopted by dietary experts in 2012 and will be updated this year. The diet is adapted to the Nordic countries, Denmark, Sweden, Norway, Finland, Greenland, the Faroe Islands, and Iceland. The diet is based on ingredients that are produced locally and thereby sustainable. Recommended foods include vegetables such as peas, beans, cabbage, onions, and root vegetables, as well as fruits including apples, pears, plums, and berries. Also recommended are nuts, seeds, whole grains, fish, and shellfish, as well as vegetable oils made from rapeseed, sunflower, or flaxseed. Finally, low-fat dairy products are also recommended, as well as significantly smaller portions of meat than currently consumed. The diet contributes to important fatty acids, minerals, vitamins, and plant materials that have a positive effect on our health and, among other things, reduce the risks of blood clots, type 2 diabetes, high blood pressure and cholesterol levels, as well as cardiovascular disease in general. Step up. Walking may reduce type 2 diabetes risks for adults 65 and older, a study has shown. The study is written by Yadira Galindo. The source is the University of California, San Diego. Walking regularly and at greater intensity may help prevent type 2 diabetes among 70 and 80-year-olds, according to one of the first studies measuring steps and pace among this population. The more steps a person takes and the more intense, the lower their risk for developing diabetes, report researchers in a study published in Diabetes Care. A key figure from our study is that for every 1,000 steps per day, our results show a 6% lower diabetes risk in this population. What that means is, if the average older adult were to take 2,000 more steps every day in addition to what they're already doing, they may expect a 12% reduction in diabetes risks, said the first author, Alexis Garduno, a third-year student at the University of California, San Diego, and San Diego State University Joint Doctoral Program in Public Health. A multi-institutional team of researchers analyzed data from the Women's Health Initiative, whose aim was characterizing physical activity and cardiovascular health in postmenopausal women. For the current prospective study, a diverse cohort of women 65 and older who did not have diabetes and who lived independently were asked to wear a research-grade accelerometer for 24 hours per day over the right hip for 1 week. The health was followed up for 7 years. We wanted to understand the extent to which stepping or walking is related to diabetes. And is 10,000 steps a day really necessary for people to reduce their risk for diabetes? Said senior author John Bellatier, PhD, MPH, assistant professor of epidemiology at the Herbert Wertheim School of Public Health and Human Longevity Science at UC San Diego. The primary aim of the study was to assess associations between total steps taken per day and the development of diabetes. The secondary aim was to evaluate whether step intensity or cadence influenced diabetes risk. Of the 4,838 women in the study, 395, or 8%, developed diabetes. Adults 65 and older often live with mobility or disability challenges. As physical activity drops, their risk for type 2 diabetes increases. According to the American Diabetes Association, 1.5 million people are diagnosed with diabetes every year. If we estimate that one-third of that population are older adults, that's 500,000 older individuals who are newly diagnosed with diabetes every year. If all of them increase their steps by 2,000 steps per day, and our 12% estimate is proven to be causal, we would expect 60,000 people each year to not get diabetes due to that increase in steps, said Bellatier. Previous prevention studies have demonstrated that regular physical activity, along with improved diet, reduces the risk of diabetes in adults. In fact, the United States Department of Health and Human Services recommends at least 150 minutes of moderate to vigorous physical activity per week to reduce the risk of numerous chronic diseases, including diabetes. Age plays an important role in levels of physical activity intensity, Bellatier said. What is moderate intensity activity for an older adult is very different than what it is what is moderate intensity activity for a middle-aged or young adult. People who have mobility disability, who do not have to walk as far, as fast, or uphill to engage in moderate to vigorous intensity activity, he said. When we talk about moderate to vigorous intensity steps, we are talking about the kind of steps that cause you to breathe a little heavy and make it harder to engage in conversation. For the average person, aged 70 to 80 years old, just walking around the block one time is moderate to vigorous intensity activity. Because all steps matter, not just those taken for exercise, the accelerometers used in the study count steps throughout the day. Whether an individual is at home, moving from room to room, taking a walk outdoors, or moving about a grocery store. Additional randomized control studies are needed to determine the exact number of steps needed for risk reduction, the researchers said. In the future, clinicians may be able to personalize a physical activity plan by analyzing how an individual's genetic risk or family history of diabetes influences the numbers of steps needed per day to reduce their risks for diabetes, said Garduno. It's important, even if you have staved off diabetes, to keep with it and to incorporate regular stepping as part of your daily schedule and make it into a routine, said Garduno. It's not enough for somebody to go on a walk once a week. Our study indicates that regular stepping is indicative of lower diabetes risk in older adults. Talking about diabetes,